This is the Home Health Revealed podcast. Hear stories from real industry leaders discussing topics affecting the ever-changing industries of home health, hospice, and palliative care.
Welcome to another episode of Home Health Revealed podcast brought to you by Health Rev Partners. I'm your host, Mike Greenlee, and as always,
I'm Hannah Vale. Today, we have a fantastic guest, Katie Eisel, who is the Payer Relations Director at OCHN and an experienced managed care consultant.
Well, and Katie shares her deepest expertise on negotiating payer contracts as a home health agency. She covers how to evaluate if a payer is a good fit based off the agency's needs and, of course, their financial model.
Yeah, she also discusses the importance of understanding reimbursement schedules, payment timelines, and proactively tracking key metrics like length of stay, denials, and appeals by payer.
And, of course, in my fabulous games, this one happened to be true or false, Katie addresses common tactics and misconceptions around payer negotiations. Her insight provided a roadmap for agencies to maximize reimbursement and build successful partnership within payers.
So whether you're new to payer negotiations or a seasoned pro, this episode has valuable tips you don't want to miss. Let's dive in. We have Katie with us today. Katie Eisel is a payer relations director of OCHN, and she's also a managed care consultant. So she's a great resource. We're going to get to talk to her today. Katie, you work day in and day out with payer relations. So tell me what that entails.
I do. I'll give you really a mountaintop view. It really is bridging gaps between the provider and the payer. The definition of relation I always tell people is condition of being related, or the manner of which things are related. And I work in on the manner part of it. So I'm that bridge. It's how the payers and the providers work together. I'd also like to call myself a welcomed buffer at times between the two, as there has long been a distaste on the provider side with managed care.
And in this episode, we want to give agencies everything they need to have in their arsenal to be prepared to negotiate with payers. And I think it's important to note that all payers are not a good fit for an agency. How do payer denial rates and the payer's operations play a role in how an agency should consider whether they want to contract with a payer?
I do agree with the statement that all payers are not a good fit for an agency, but I think the fit part can vary greatly by agency, if you ask me. So for an agency to consider what's the agency's cost of goods sold, I think is important. How does the payer fit into needing to subsidize that payment or not by other payers or by Medicare if they take Medicare, or if they already subsidize perhaps their Medicaid population as well? Does the agency need to accept this payer to be a good community health partner and maintain relations and referral streams? I think that's something very important to consider. I always start there really with those couple items. And I do believe denial rates and operational relations with a payer are workable in my opinion, but the agency first needs to determine what the bottom line is for them to survive. And if the partnership needed to remain or improve community relations and visibility. So like, is it needed for you to be able to still keep your community presence? Is it not? Will it improve that presence in the community? So again, I kind of look at it, I think, in somewhat of a different way for providers. But at the end of the day, figure out what your bottom line is and then work your way up from there.
You know, Katie, this is one of the most important topics that actually we're asked questions all the time about payers and negotiation with payers. So I thought it would be appropriate for you and I to play a game called truth or false. Not truth there, double dare, promise or repeat, nothing like that, but just truth or false. In terms of how payers negotiate, their tactics behind negotiating and stuff like that. Okay. So you ready to play the game?
I am, but I can't give you just a true or false. I can tell you that.
Okay. No. You got to go in depth. Here we go. Ready? Ready for number one?
Go.
All right. Payers may intentionally drag out the negotiation process, hoping that agencies will become frustrated and accept less favorable terms. They may request multiple rounds of revisions or stall on providing timely responses.
I'll be honest here. I'm not sure it's intentional as much as it highly depends on the payer's bandwidth within that department. That might be more likely where the strategy would lie. And so what does that particular, contracting networking department look like at that payer? I also think timing within the payer's approval process is to be considered. Payers often have meetings usually quarterly to discuss access, new provider requests, financial performance, et cetera. So if you're applying at the very beginning of a quarter, it will likely be 1 to 2 quarters, 6 months to nail down a contract, depending on the load that that particular rep at the payer is dealing with. So no, I don't think it's the stall is always intentional for who the provider may be working with as much as their hands are tied by that internal process. I also believe the multiple rounds of revisions are simply due to the provider perhaps not understanding non-negotiables. I have seen that. And what constitutes a run by legal. So meaning when a provider is requesting revisions on the contract that do require altering sections of the contract that are not set up for individualization, like timely filing, internal initial term length or authorization, then yes, the process would be drawn out. But it's usually on the provider's part, I would say, in that scenario.
Okay. Number two, larger, more dominant payers may use their market position to exert pressure on agencies, threatening to exclude them from their network if they don't accept the offered terms.
I think it's a fair assumption to the naked eye of a typical provider that that might be true, but I'm going to say that it's probably false. Larger providers simply have a larger saturation of patient lives, and it does make it harder to say no for us providers. When that could potentially deeply affect the agency's community partnership and presence, smaller payers don't have as much of that impact, right, as the larger payers. So I think it is where if you're a preferred partner within an ACO or a hospital system that you leverage that information to let the payer know that you're not dispensable and or you're a key piece in the access to care for the community. So again, I don't think that that's intentional, but I think it's a fair assumption. It happens all the time.
Okay. How about this? Number three, here we go. Payers often emphasize the need to reduce healthcare costs and may use this as a justification for offering lower reimbursement rates or limiting the scope of covered services.
They do. That is 100% true.
True. But hey, we got a non-politically correct
got
answer.
One.
You know what I mean? We got one. We're one for three.
I have a caveat to that too, though. So, but, you know, I'm trying to change that thought. That first, you know, going, really trying to get the payers to change the thought that first going into the rate is not the right thing to do when dealing with patients' lives and care needed. I think nothing probably rubs any of us, you know, the wrong way more when we have that being the first step that a payer takes to try to reduce cost. So reducing the rate first isn't a patient first approach in my mind at all. And that's what the payers are doing. They're supposed to be managing the care of the patient. And a rate has nothing to do with managing the care of the patient. Care of the patient and cost of the patient, I always like to say to the payers, are really two completely different terms in a contractual relationship to me. The problem with payers and providers right now is that they both are discussing cost of the patient. So we're guilty too. We both need to be discussing the care of the patient. You will often see the clinical teams from the provider speaking from the heart about how care is affected and have the non-clinical personnel making decisions at the payer level with no true understanding or relation to what the clinical staff at the provider is trying to relay about concerns with care under those rates. So it's the problem of speaking essentially two different languages, and we both do it. But yes, it's true. They do go to rate first.
Okay. Number four, payers may have access to more data and industry insights than agencies, allowing them to make more informed decisions that may not be readily available to an agency.
That is true as well. Payers typically do have more access to data that they want to look at, right? And that they care about. So that's a little bit of caveat to that answer, as well as it's data that they're interested in and data that they want to keep track of, which, you know, to go back to the previous question that you gave me, the true or false on, you know, that does relate back to them wanting to look to reduce cost right off of the bat. So it's true, but it's something that the agency can ask to see and have discussions with the payer to better understand. That can be done through ensuring you're setting up routine monthly meetings with your payer representatives. I can give you more information on that in a minute.
No, I like the answer of they can request it. And I wonder how many agencies know or would think about requesting that information, right? So that's good. All right. Last one in our true false game. Some payers may propose bundle payment models which can be complex and challenging for agencies to navigate, potentially leading to unintended financial consequences.
You know, that's a light true, I would say. I'm not going to call it false because I have not seen a ton of bundled payment models. I have seen the payer certainly follow CMS's lead with the inception of PDGM and no longer allow for additional payment or bill back of non-routine supplies. I think that's something that all providers should still try to negotiate within their contracts, especially if they're less than 100% of the Medicare fee schedule or of episodic rates. So I do think a value-based contract or a risk-based contract can be too complex to answer your question, very much so, second part of it, I guess. For some agencies, my recommendation is for you to use the tools that you have in your tool belt that CMS is so kindly giving us. And that is, look at your value-based purchasing score from CMS. And we all know what's included. And if we don't, we need to make sure we're aware of what's included in your value-based purchasing score. And my opinion is if you aren't above that 75th percentile for your value-based purchasing score, then it's likely you're not ready for a complex contract. So that's my advice to you. So think about that. And once you get your score up there, that shows that you are definitely able to manage your patients. You're able to pivot when needed, and you're likely more innovative than your peers.
So Katie, can you talk about how home health agencies effectively can counter some of these tactics that, although maybe just perceived true, to negotiate more favorable contracts?
One, they should thoroughly research the payer's operations, financial performance, and industry reputation, right? And that can be done really through calling other agencies, sister agencies, if you have more than one, you know, within a particular region. This can be leveraged during negotiations to make stronger case for fair contract terms, right? If you know this payer is particularly notorious for having a large administrative burden with collecting payment, that's something that I think you need to bring to the table when you're negotiating. I think agencies should also aim to establish a collaborative relationship with the payer, focusing on, you know, finding mutually beneficial solutions rather than adversarial negotiations. I like to say you do get more bees, you know, with honey. So making sure that you are very much so professional in your interactions. And to be quite honest, one of the best things you can do as a provider to set yourselves apart from every other provider is to be very, very sweet and professional, because we do know that, on average, most people aren't such when they're reaching out to a payer. They're usually frustrated, have seen some sort of, you know, reduction or a delay in payment, and or their patients aren't right getting the care that they need. They feel so. Generally, if you can set yourself apart that way, that's one of the first and easiest ways you can do that. The other recommendation is agencies should have a deep understanding of their own operational costs and patient outcomes. This data can be used to demonstrate the value they bring and justify their requested reimbursement rates. Even though that's not what the payer is looking at, it does give you some leverage, right? Engaging as well in experienced legal counsel, just in case. That can be invaluable when you're navigating a complex contract language and ensuring, you know, the agencies aren't signing away their rights or accepting unfavorable terms. I do encourage that if you're not comfortable with reviewing contracts yourself. And then agencies should also be proactive in proposing value-based or outcome-based payment models that align with the industry shift towards value-driven care if they have the bandwidth. So trying to do what I'm trying to do, right, with the payers. I'm trying to get them to kind of turn towards where value-based purchasing is taking all of us. And that is, you know, driving towards value-based care and making sure that the payers are paying us for those good outcomes, right? It's kind of like right now we have each of us speaking different languages. It's not apples to apples. And then lastly, I would not allow a disconnect between your clinical team and whoever's managing contracts. I think that's another, probably one of the biggest, issues that I do see is that whoever's managing the contracts has no connection to your clinical team. And to be quite honest, medical necessity, timeliness of documentation, and proper utilization management within your clinical team is crucial. I'm a nurse myself, and to ensure that you don't have any mud on your face when criticizing the payer for large amounts of denials and administrative burden is huge. And that's what you do see sometimes, is that you know, we're worried about the amount of denials. The billing team is talking about all these denials, but then when we actually kind of, you know, boil all the fat off and look at it, when you look at those notes, there isn't good medical necessity. There isn't good documentation. There isn't proper, you know, frequencies and utilization of those disciplines either. So you kind of side with the payer on that. So you want to make sure that you're really bridging that disconnect, I would say.
You know, Mike Greenlee's 101 of negotiation starts with when I call somebody, like a company, like I need something, I need a favor, like a discount, or I need something. I always say, are you working miracles today? And they, and if they say no, I hang up, call again, try to get someone that says, I might be, because you know what? Surprisingly enough, that line, people want to help people. And if you come across like pretty nice, like, hey, Hannah, you working miracles today? She says,
yeah,
no.
So I'm now like, everybody who listens to this podcast is going to be using that line.
That's Mike's 101 of negotiation. Are you working miracles today? If they say no, or they don't even act like they're excited, hang up, call back.
I love that. That's great.
Okay, Katie, let's talk a little bit about reimbursement. What are the reimbursement schedules? What are they like? And should agencies inquire about payers' payment timelines and any potential delays to ensure that cash flow is not disrupted?
Reimbursement schedules is a good question. They vary by state or region, I would say. Payers also review budgets by state and region as well. We kind of touched on that a little bit ago. I think the provider should ensure that there's a timely payment term within the contract always when a clean claim is filed. The delays in cash flow are inevitable, and it's the amount that really is what the agency can control. So, I mean, by that, a stellar revenue cycle process or revenue cycle provider is key to what I call raising the red flag immediately when billers notice a delay in payment from a payer or when there's an uptick in ADRs from a payer. Most payers will pay the clean claims within 30 days. So I don't think that that's necessarily an issue. With that being said, I think the revenue cycle team or contracted revenue cycle provider in an agency needs to be aware of what an agency's DSO is as well. It's a metric that I think is often overlooked in my opinion, but it's crucial to identifying efficiency gaps between you and your payer. So I love to recommend that agencies know what their DSO is by payer so they can hopefully identify those gaps a little bit easier.
Yeah, you're speaking our language. Let me ask you this. How often should revenue cycle specialist, AKA/billers, follow up on a claim? Like meaning that a commercial, whatever the case may be, you mentioned that most claims will pay within 30 days, but should they not check on that claim for 30 days or should they still check on that claim just to make sure there's no like update on that claim?
That's a great question. I would say if this is what you believe to be a clean claim, I think it's fine to wait that 30 days. If that's within the contract, if that's the, you know, what their payment, what it says in the contract for them to remit payment to the agency, if it says 30 days, I think you allow that on what you would assume is a clean claim. If it this is a claim that is denied or it's kicked back for some sort of reason and you want to, you know, file an appeal or reconsideration, you know, that's where I think that you need to take a little bit more extreme ownership, and there needs at least every 14 days follow up from the agency or the revenue cycle provider to ensure that that claim is being looked at. So, because at the end of the day, after 30 days, it's kind of out of your control per se, and you want to try to take that control back with your DSO. And it is true that, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. I have always erred on every 14 days, making sure that you're getting someone looking at that, or you're poking or prodding or nudging them to take a look at any claims that are not clean claims.
Someone is owning an agency and they're listening. How would they know, or how does the RCM person necessarily know if it's clean or not? So they bill it out today, whatever system that they use or clearinghouse, whatever the case may be, how do they know that it is clean?
Well, I think they know if it's clean, if it was accepted, right, by the payer generally. And what I mean is by a clean claim, you're assuming that it's going through, and maybe perhaps my terminology is not as clear, because, you know, you can have a clean claim go through, right? It has all of just the preemptive requirements that are needed just to get that claim through to the payer. However, there could be some reasons that it gets kicked back, right? So it could be, you know, the rates don't appear to be accurate according to the fee schedule, the agreed upon fee schedule. There could be no authorization for some of the dates of service that are on that claim. And those are items that it's going to get kicked back. So I would say, in general, because you would assume that a claim that goes out the door is clean for the most part. Now, again, where if you start to see a longer DSO for a payer, that's where those things I mentioned, like maybe there's not authorization on every single data service that's going out. If you start to see that DSO climb up, generally there's something that's happening on our end as the provider that's causing that to happen. And so that's where you'll identify those issues.
Yeah. Well, the reason why I asked the question is because our standard practice, I don't ever want to go 30 days. Because then what if something did come back, let's say day 10, and we waited 30 days. And so you just basically lost quite a bit of days, which could, again, hurt cash flow. Our standard practice is 15 days, no matter what they have to.
Wonderful. That's phenomenal. That's great. It really, really is. So you're talking about actually looking into check to see if those claims were actually paid. Correct.
Yeah, our system automatically flags it at 15 days.
That's
and
wonderful.
They have to go in and check on the claim.
Amazing. That's definitely probably industry best practice out of the industry. So that's great.
Yeah,
so
I actually made a good decision.
How can agencies research the payer's reputation for timely payments and clear communication and fair negotiation so they can decide on the front end if they even want to work with that payer?
Sure. Great question. Again, these are really, really good questions. It's hard to answer, as I'm rarely heard saying that the payer is to blame for payment delays based on probably how I just answered that last question. But I think that's really a burden often owned by the provider. So 99% of the time, in my experience, it's the provider who is missing something. The communication to the provider from the payer on how to fix the problem is the bigger issue. So I like to do my research by first testing out accessibility of the payer's staff and their structural setup. So do I have the ability right now in this moment when I'm looking at a payer, do I know who my payer representative is going to be? What's the structural setup? Do they have a separate claims line of service that will process the claims? Do they have somebody that also is working on access to care? Do they have a separate clinical department? Like, what are all their silos within that payer that are going to affect me and the ability to get payment? And then, are there assigned provider reps for each of their silos, or is it just, do we just have a provider rep strictly for, you know, contracting and network development? Are there regional reps or supervisors with accessibility as well? I always like to know that, because when I'm not getting the answer that I need at a certain level, I certainly do like to escalate. Not all the time. It's not my favorite thing to do, right? Because I do believe that, you know, you try to work through that chain of command as best you can. I do not just mean like existence of titles or names, but really like the ability to verify their existence and preemptively pledge to support you as a provider. So sure, someone can tell you, oh yes, we're built like this. We have this layer, this layer, this layer. But I really would encourage people to pressure that provider rep to actually introduce you. Hey, this is a new provider that's considering coming on. They want to make sure that they have the support that they need to be able to service your patients. Can you go ahead and do a quick introduction? If they do that, then you've now got that person's information, right? So part of it's kind of vetting your own ability. And then if you have a good relationship and tangible support from the payer, the likelihood of eventually wanting to work with payers much higher.
Yeah. How often should, so payers change around what, October? Is there like some changes that payers do? Is it a certain month around October or something? Is that true?
Sure. Open enrollment. Yes. Yeah. There's another special time. Yes. After the first year for the Medicare beneficiaries.
Yeah. How often should an agency do a payer assessment on all their payers and, hey, what's happening here? And does it, you know, is that something they should do annually, biannually? Because there's a lot of agencies we talk to, and they'll bring up to us that, hey, we don't feel like we're getting paid as much as we should. And so we start talking, well, when's the last time you had a conversation? It could be 2 to 3 years, sometimes even longer.
So my recommendation is every 6 months. And I really encourage that every 6 months to be right smack dab in the middle of the year if you're able to do it. And the reason why I recommend that is because if you do see that you need to make changes and you're not headed in the right direction, and this is really because, guys, managed care is really becoming the largest payer for all of us within our portfolio of who we work with. So you want to be able to turn, right, and pivot and change things up if you need to in order to put your trajectory in a better direction for the end of the year. Waiting and just doing it annually doesn't allow you to do that, right, to make the changes. It's kind of the year's over and it is what it is. So don't position yourself that way. I strongly encourage everybody to do it at least every 6 months.
Whose responsibility is it to market that there's a partnership or a contract in place? Does the payer announce the affiliation, or is that on the provider side?
I would say it's on the provider side, because payers usually announce by updating their online provider registry or in-network provider list when they get to it. So, which could be monthly, could be quarterly. It could be whenever that person gets to it. So I would say it's 100% on the provider to ensure that the community is made aware of the new partnership and how exciting it is. Absolutely. Use that for a marketing, you know, one-up anytime you can.
Yeah. So, all right, Katie, I got another two-pronged question. You ready for this? I'm trying to see if I can stump you, and I haven't done it so far. So I think
this one may get you.
So when you look from a perspective from whoever's handling your RCM, or even say it's a company like us that handles RCM, what data should we be providing agencies, or what data could we provide agencies that would help them prepare better for contract negotiations?
I could go on and on about what payers should consider in contract negotiations to truly reduce the cost of care, right? And I'm working on that, like I told you, in my daily endeavors with the payers. But the agency really, in my opinion, should have a good understanding of their length of stay by payer. That is something that the payers do want to see at times, depending on if they already don't have their metrics, like we talked about. Your DSO by payer, the number of appeals by payer, the number of denials by payer, the number of ADRs by payer, the number of hospitalizations by payer, and visit utilization by payer, by discipline, I would say. I also think it's necessary to understand what percentage of their census that payer is. And I'll tell you why with that is, at the end of the day, if you are unable to resolve issues with a payer and they're a large percentage of your revenue, an agency may need to consider holding on accepting that payer until issues are resolved, to avoid like a large payment project, if you will, and significant delay to their overall DSO. So again, always make sure you consider, know that data. What percentage of my census is that payer as well?
Now, based off that answer, is there any matrix that an agency should have, like things you mentioned, to be able to say, hey, are we good? Are we in the middle, or are we bad? Like, so when they do go in for negotiations, they've got all the ammunition to have a well-structured conversation to show that the payer—
Right, like a benchmarking for where other agencies are with the same payers.
It's worth your time to deal with us, because, you know, we're good. We're great at what we do. Now we want to add you all so we can continue to grow. So in some of that data, is there any like benchmarking that you know of that's out there that says, okay, my length of stay should be X, or my DSO should be X for this particular payer, or my denial? Any data there that says, hey, if you have this, probably pretty good to have a good conversation?
I think if you ask the payers for that, they will give you some of that information as far as what they're looking for. Other than that, although it's outdated, we do have a lot of this information to kind of benchmark ourselves against our peers, and that's through, you know, your reports on iKeys. And then also, you know, value-based purchasing as well. Not value-based purchasing, I wouldn't say it gives you a lot of those metrics that I mentioned, but I think iKeys does in your provider outcomes reports. A lot of that information is included in there. But also, again, it's having a good relationship with whoever you work with your revenue cycle, whether it be internal or, you know, like providers like you. I think that it would be great, right, to be able to have the ability to have those reports developed and at your fingertips to take to the managed care plan. So just to answer the question, not that I'm aware of, I mean, there certainly are products out there that do give a lot of this information, but not not with as much of the revenue cycle flavor, I guess, that I try to look at when I'm looking at the overall process.
Now, are these contracts confidential? So like, let's say you have a contract, let's say I have a contract. Let's say you and I are having a coffee or a beer, all right? And I say, I'm getting reimbursed X, and you're like, well, I'm getting reimbursed X. Is that a violation of any contract?
Not for individual providers, but it's very non-typical for providers to share that information with each other. But certainly if it's something you catch wind of, that's not something that is anything that you could be, in trouble for, I guess. But, certainly that is something that I do encourage other, providers to do is find out what their rates are in their area, however you want to figure that out. But certainly we are all in this together, and I'm by no means asking everybody to, collectively bargain together against the managed care plans. That's a bit of a conflict, right? But try to make sure that you understand what your peers are receiving in the areas that you service to make sure that you aren't settling, right, for something that is truly going to hurt your patients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's why I brought it up, because if I was trying to negotiate a contract, if I don't really know what other people are getting, how do I know if I'm getting a good deal, right?
Correct.
And that may be a benefit of using a consultant like you, Katie. I imagine you have at least an idea, a database of some sort, know what payers can get paid by different providers.
Yes,
or by different payers, sorry.
Well, and you just listened to, Katie, everything you've said today, which has been awesome. But I look at it and say, wow, there's a lot to know about this. So it doesn't seem as easy just to kind of pick up a phone or fill out an app and hope to God you get approved. Like, there's a lot of stuff that goes into it. And then just as you were describing, you got to really know your stuff. And then you even got to know kind of where to pivot based off how they answer. And that's a learned craft. So in your opinion, if I'm an agency and I'm saying, okay, it's time for me to do my payer reevaluation, maybe even some negotiation, how do I go about doing that? Or is it just best for me to find someone like you that says, Katie, here's my goal. I don't, because their bandwidth is they're maxed out, right? And so this is one more thing. And I could see anybody, I would get frustrated trying to do this, trying to figure all this data up. So, I guess how important it is that they really want to grow and scale, they want to get maximum reimbursement. Does it make sense to say, hey, don't try to become the expert, hire the expert. And then as you're working with the expert, you're going to learn a lot more how this works. And eventually you can take it on. But in the early stages, do they hire someone like you that says, hey, let's get this together?
I think so. Because here's the deal. This is the way that I generally work. And that is, I like to work myself right out of what I'm doing, right? I don't want to be needed. I like to help people grow their knowledge and grow their ability to be able to do what I do all on their own. And so I also think as well, if you think that you have a good grip on your evaluation of your payers every 6 months, it never hurts. And I also operate this way, is I don't like any one idea to be start and finish just my idea, my concept, my theory, right? I know that even if I take 1% of someone else's idea, concept, or theory, and I put that together at mine at the end, I am 101% versus 100%, right? And so that, making sure that you are humble like that, and making sure that you don't believe that just where you are, kind of like how you said, Mike, where you just believe you got it all, you're kind of like hunkered down, you think you've got it all under wraps. I would never encourage that, at least for the first time, or it may be in your next cycle that you're going to review your payer caseload and how you're, what that looks like for your agency. I would recommend having some, outside eyes taking a look and helping you make sure that you're not missing anything, right? It's the same thing when, we have a new puppy right now. And so, some people will stop over after a week and they'll say, oh my goodness, he's grown so much. And we're like, we don't see it, So it's that same concept, right? It's that same analogy that, if you're looking at it all the time, you may not see some pretty big red flags that would allow you to improve significantly.
Yeah, right. That's what I think. That's why there's experts like you that know this. It can at least guide, you may not know it all, but you know a dadgum lot, right? And having somebody that has the intellect to help you navigate through it, I think is critically important. So I'm impressed with all your knowledge and what you've been able to share with us today. I think this is going to be a fantastic podcast. I think a lot of people are going to listen to it.
Yeah, this has been a really great episode.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. Great insight. I love it. I love all of it.
Thank you.
So, Katie, if listeners want to get a hold of you, get in contact with you, where can they find you?
So they can reach me at healthcarepayersc@outlook.com. That's my email. And then my cell phone number I have listed as well. And I can give that to you as well, Hannah, that you can place at the end of this podcast. But yeah.
Okay.
And then obviously, if you are a member of the OCHN here in Ohio, they know how to reach me, and they do.
Thanks so much, Katie. It's been so great hearing from you today. And to all of our listeners, we will see you next time.